From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, Project Milwaukee Segregation Matters continues with a look at education. We'll meet two suburban social studies teachers who've taken it upon themselves to make race something their students talk about year-round.
We kind of feel like we have this moment in eighth grade where they're curious, and you can tell from the discussion about race. They have these like feelings they want to talk about, and we thought we can explore it.
Later, writer Kwame Alexander says literature can be a great tool for fostering empathy in young readers.
They see themselves, they see their friends. I think it's only when we begin to introduce, well, I think this book will be for my black kids, and this
right.
book should probably be for my white kids, and this book should be for my Latino kids. And so the adults begin to segregate the literature.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Metro Milwaukee has a segregation problem, not least within area schools. Many researchers say that Milwaukee schools are about as integrated today as they were in the 1960s.
What does that mean for kids and how they learn? As Aaron McCarthy and Colleen Perry see it, the persistence of segregation actually opens the door for more conversations about race within the classroom.
McCarthy and Perry teach middle school social studies in Greendale, a predominantly white suburb. Their eighth grade classes are all about American history, a history that, as they teach it, is a complex story involving multiple cultures and communities.
Lake Effect's Rachel Morello spoke with the duo about how they try to broaden students' understanding of race through a new approach to American history.
4 years ago, I attended a National Endowment for the Humanities workshop in New York for 2 weeks, and it was about race and politics in the Civil War. And then I found out all this information, really immersed in it, and I came back and realized I can't tell the story the same way anymore, because the way the textbook typically leaves off after the Civil War and Reconstruction and steps away from the story of African Americans and then just comes back to it 100 years later in the Civil Rights Movement. And we decided we wanted to commit to like telling a full story all the way through of ups and downs, right? Would you agree? So that was probably about 3 years ago?
Three or 4 years ago. So 3 years ago we made the switch, right? So taking into consideration not to stop after Reconstruction and leave out that big blank space, because Erin is a historian and she uses primary sources to tell stories. So she went out and gathered up all these sources that we could use as, you know, evidence that kids could examine. And we came up with an activity where they make a giant timeline and we're really following the African American struggle for equality through time, but also learning about history at the same time. Mm-hmm. So we're doing American history, but there's a bend. We're always reevaluating where are we at this point? Do all people have equal rights? And then we switched it up again. Now we've included women, Native Americans, African Americans, so all of the minority or the out groups that are always struggling for that equality in our democracy.
Are you guys solely focusing on those things now, or are you still building in what I guess people would think of as traditional American history?
Yeah, so I think what we've done is we divided up kind of arbitrarily into 20-year segments instead of 10, because, I don't know, why, 20. And you have to always understand the context so that you can understand the primary sources. So we use either some sort of anchor text, we call it, so it might be they're going to a website and reading about a time period, and then getting a feel for what were people like, what was popular at the time, what are the big events, like those markers in the timeline that we're all used to in textbooks, and they get to know the time period, and then we delve into what's it really like for groups that maybe are traditionally left out. Mm-hmm. So they still get it, like they still get the information about the big things, like the big wars and the Great Depression, but certainly not at a level where they are experts on it. You know, we know that in high school, they're going to study it again, much more in depth. So we kind of feel like we have this moment in eighth grade where they're curious, and you can tell from the discussion about race. They have these like feelings they want to talk about, and we thought we can explore it. And then next time they talk about these topics in history in high school, they'll maybe have a hook, a reason why they're interested in a different way.
Can you guys talk specifically about making the switch in Greendale? This is a majority white community. I didn't realize it was a planned community when it was first put together.
Right.
But talk about how your discussions might be different than you expected or just how it works here?
Mm-hmm. Because we teach eighth grade, they come out of seventh grade a little crazy, like hormones. And in eighth grade, a lot of kids are waking up. They're waking up to be the people that they will be, you know, and they have a natural sense of like social justice. And so I just feel like to jump on this moment with them and be able to, you know, help them to understand the world around them in a different way. So when I proposed our curriculum, even to our school board, and it's been 7 years, the focus has always been on the struggle for equality for all Americans. And you can read it. It was 7 years ago that we wrote it. I think I'm realizing it or my goal more today than I was 5 years ago or, you know, 6 years ago. In Greendale, we have the Greendale attributes. So the community and students and teachers and parents have all gotten together and defined the attributes, what we think every Greendale student should look like by the end of 12th grade. And one of those attributes is under citizenship. So it's kind of like an unfolding, like we're trying to teach the whole child, and it's very important in Greendale to do that. It is a community that's separated from Milwaukee, and we are less diverse, but there is definitely support for developing the whole child into someone who can live in a multicultural, like a world.
Do you guys ever work with schools where it does look different than you and talk about how what you're teaching might be different than how they're teaching?
I think that's probably the next level to what we want to do. I mean, we've presented at like the National Council for Social Studies in New Orleans, but it was more about how we plan things out using inquiry. Because I think it is that we're in this white community, mm-hmm. and you don't want to come across as though you're an expert, right, on something that you have no experience with, right? And I personally have had that experience being like, I worked at a Swedish museum. I used to be in museums before I came to education. So I wasn't Swedish. And so could I tell their story? Yeah, I could, right? So can I tell this story because of my training as a historian? Yes. But to be an authority and to talk to people about, say, this is how to talk about race, you know, it's kind of like watching that discussion. The few kids we have that represent a minority group, they had a different perspective. You know, they said you can try and change people, but you have to change people's hearts. Right. And it's great that we bring that out, because I think the other thing about Greendale is on the surface, it looks like very homogenous, right? It's very white, and if you look at the percentages, but the way the planned community was designed, you know, every home here was a rental, you know, so you could get here without being middle class necessarily. And there's still a lot of rental opportunities in Greendale. So people, we do have diverse students. We have ELL students. We have students who've come from other countries. And I think there's different income levels, and they don't realize that. And that would be a very difficult, even more difficult topic to talk about. You know, I think it would make them even more uncomfortable as eighth graders to stand out because of their income. I think, go back to the actual question, I'd love to talk to other people about it, but I think now that we've done it enough years, we're probably comfortable enough to say, this is what we think, but I'd like to frame it as, how can you help me to make this a richer experience, you know?
I'd love to be able to hook up with another school or different schools and be able to bring kids together, because we just don't have that opportunity here.
Do you guys see there being benefits or drawbacks or both to talking about issues like race in a school setting when you're among people who look like you?
Well, there's definitely a drawback. We don't have the voice here. They're in a majority, you know, white situation. So are they really able to dig in and share? So I think that is a disadvantage. But I also feel like I don't want to study history and focus on equality and, you know, just looking at different minority groups and how our history has affected or how they have fought for their equality throughout history without paying attention to who they are. And so, you know, we're trying to make it work here, but I think it is difficult. But I think I would be irresponsible to not have a conversation about it.
I would agree that the drawback would be I have students who feel uncomfortable, right? Because they're just a small percentage and they kind of feel like they're, no one wants to stand out in middle school at all. Mm-hmm. And it inevitably happens that everyone turns to them literally and looks at them for like, can you represent your entire race for us? And they don't want that to happen. And they've talked to the counselor, and we've kind of talked through it, that it's still a valuable thing to do. I think the very first time we started teaching this story through an African-American lens, it was great and the kids were curious, but then I had to step back and say, I don't think they're connecting to it in the way they're really meant to. And I think that was the point at which we shifted to the attributes, right? And thinking about the whole child. And so that's when we started taking a break from the regular history lessons and just focusing on empathy. And so who are you? Who am I? What's the same about us? What's different? That way you start to realize I am more than just a white person, right? There's a complexity to white people. Not that I want to overplay that, but at least it gives them a starting point. You can talk a lot about how teenagers are discriminated against. Again, it's not the same thing, but at least gets them sort of empathizing with the experience. And then we talk about the Asian experience. We've got a Puerto Rican man's experience. We've got a white woman in the South who thought she was white, but she ended up having an ancestor 200 years before who was black, and that categorized her as black. So I think getting them to really focus on themselves, which is what teenagers love to do anyways, is a good entry point. And I don't know, is that an advantage? I think it'd be great if we had a more diverse student body, but I'm not going to stop what we're doing just because we don't have the diversity yet.
Erin McCarthy and Colleen Perry teach social studies at Greendale Middle School. They spoke with Lake Effect's Rachel Morello.
There was a time when Milwaukee schools were far more integrated, though the period of forced busing and integration was fraught with its own tensions as well. We talked a few years ago with Emily Ballou, a writer who grew up in Milwaukee before moving to Australia. Her 2005 novel, Fatherlands, is set in Milwaukee during the time of busing. She described how her experience of being bused to elementary school shaped the novel and her own life.
It was quite strange, I think, in terms of knowing that you were the minority in a way at the school, but knowing on another level that you're a majority in the world, and trying to reconcile differences of race and color while being taught all this Black American history was really, really eye-opening for me, you know, having to watch Roots for homework.
Which is something that that Cherry Laurel does in the book.
Yes, which was, I mean, at the time I remember that being very excited that we had television for homework. And it took about one night of watching it before I begged my mother to not force me to watch the rest of it. I was so upset by it. And when I wrote the book, I went back and watched the whole thing, which I actually hadn't seen the whole thing because I couldn't bear to watch it. And it was, you know, despite it being dated, I guess, as a film, it's profoundly moving and quite disturbing to think of an 8-year-old watching that, but also very important. It's really stuck in my psyche that the whole slavery issue was very, very strong.
What about from a practical kind of on the ground level, what was it like for an 8-year-old white girl to be on the playground in the classroom with blacks at the time that she had never experienced?
I mean, on one level, you know, everyone kind of got along in the classrooms and it became the norm. That was what we experienced and shared. But there was definitely a getting used to period. But yet, if I think about being sent to some, you know, lush green private school grounds, you know, I'm really happy to have had the experience I had because it allowed me to see a greater portion of the real world.
Writer Emily Ballou speaking with us in 2006 about her novel Fatherlands, which was based in part on her experience growing up in Milwaukee during the time of forced busing to integrate schools here.
Don't forget, listen all this week for more installments in our Project Milwaukee Segregation Matters series, and you can also read more about the subject and listen back to other stories at WUWM.com.
Writer Kwame Alexander says he hopes his novels for middle grade students help kids see the humanity in everyone. We'll talk with him and musician Randy Preston after a break. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We've been talking about segregation in the Milwaukee area this week during our Project Milwaukee series, but writer Kwame Alexander's books for middle grade readers are one way that young people are coming together instead of moving apart.
Alexander had penned more than a dozen books for young readers before writing The Crossover, a novel in verse about two basketball-playing twin brothers. It won the Newbery Medal in 2015, and it was followed by another novel in verse, Booked, with a soccer theme. The books have drawn in boys and girls regardless of ethnic background, and have been hailed for making poetry cool.
Alexander's latest book returns to basketball as a metaphor, but it's not a novel. It is a collection of poems and essays called The Playbook, 52 Rules to Aim, Shoot, and Score in This Game Called Life. He and musician Randy Preston spoke at a couple of Milwaukee-area middle schools last week. They stopped by the Lake Effect studio as well and offered up a few songs from the mixtape they recorded based on Alexander's books, including this one.
Ladies and gentlemen, presenting The Playbook by Kwame Alexander and Randy Preston.
Be a star.
Be a star.
In your mind.
Are you recording?
Day and night.
Day and night.
Let it shine.
Let it shine.
Be a star.
Be a star.
In your mind.
Fourth grade, fifth
day
grade,
and night.
Sixth grade.
Let it shine.
It doesn't matter. You gotta believe in yourself, even when it seems that no one else does. Never let anyone lower your goals. Always shoot for the sun, and you will shine. You've got to know the greatness that comes before you. You've got to know the greatness that comes with you.
Be a star.
Be a star.
In your mind.
Join in, Mitch.
Day and night.
Day and night.
Let it shine.
Let it shine.
Be a star in your mind.
That's Randy Preston.
Day and night. Let it shine.
We are sharing some axioms and proverbs from The Playbook. 52 rules to aim, shoot, and score in the game of life. It's all about being a star, which is why we're glad to be here today in the studio of the biggest star here in Milwaukee. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr.
Mitch Tyke.
Tyke.
Mr. Mitch Tyke.
Yes, Mitch, yes, Mitch, 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 Mitch.
And the crowd goes wild.
Well, Kwame Alexander and Randy Preston, welcome to Lake Effect. It's really a thrill to have you here.
It's great to be back, Mitch. Well, it's great to be in the studio with you.
Pleasure.
All right, so let me ask you, how do you see Playbook connecting to its spiritual cousins, the Booked and before that, The Crossover?
Spiritual cousins, it sounds so divine.
Mm. But it's good, though. I like it.
Yeah. Well, you know, The Crossover featured these two boys, Josh and JB, who were stars on and off the court, who had a really cool, funny, you know, dad who shared these basketball rules for life with them. And the rules really resonated with young people as I traveled around the country, and I thought, well, I should really write more rules, you know? Mm-hmm. And so decided to write, you know, 42 more rules and ended up creating 52 rules to help you aim, shoot, and score in the game of life. And sort of the where it came from was, as a child, I remember hearing sort of sayings and weird, I guess, proverbs from my grandparents and my father. My grandmother used to say things like, dishwater gives back no images.
What in the world?
Exactly. I'd be like, what are you talking about? Yeah. My father would say, you can't know what you don't know.
And that's really true, I think.
It is, but as an eight-year-old, you're like, what in the world are you talking about?
What does it mean?
And so I wanted to write a book about some of that stuff that I still remember, but do it in a way that would be cool for, like, kids. Like your daughter, Mitch.
Well, I think my daughter already thinks you're cool. But, you know, I was reading this book and thinking about how she might take to the advice in it. And, you know, I was wondering, do you think not just her, but, you know, many of your young readers will get that, you know, even though the inside papers of this book are textured like a basketball, that a lot of these lessons are about more than just fast breaks, that this is about life?
Nah, who cares?
Right, right.
I mean, why, we don't concern ourselves with that. Here's why. And I'm being flippant when I say who cares.
Right.
I shouldn't be. Because I do care. That's why I'm here.
Exactly.
But here's what I mean.
And God bless you for it.
Basketball is the hook. Mm-hmm. Sports is the metaphor. When they read The Crossover, yeah, we want them to quick shoulder shake, a slick eye fake. Number 28 is way past late. He's reading me like a book, but I turn the page and watch him look. We want them to get all that. But we also want them to get the message about how family is so important. About friendship. And I think they're gonna get that. You know, I'm not the didactic writer. I'm the clever, you know, under the cover. Call me the undercover brother. I'm delivering a message because I do write with an intentional message.
And the goal is for you to get that, but for not for me to beat you over the head with it. So I'm all about using sports as a metaphor, and with the hopes, if I'm doing my job well enough, that the kids are going to take away some messages that are more about life off the court.
Do you think they'll listen to you and read you, Kwame Alexander, or listen to you, Randy Preston, in a way that they might not listen to their parents if they were saying the same thing?
I absolutely think that. I think that...
That's Randy talking, y'all.
Yeah, I think that when...
Randy, when you talk, you should probably like play the guitar before you start.
Oh, just as a little key?
Yeah,
just
so they know. Randy's about to talk.
As I was saying. I honestly think that when kids are presented with an experience, I think what happens when we show up, it's author visit. Yeah, they've heard an author before. But now we have an experience that we're offering. So there's more than simply, my name is blah, 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 blah. And I think that it opens them up to more information that we're giving, more messages, more thematic stuff that we're talking about. And they're more aware of it and they're more open to it. And so I think that, you know, one of the cool things about this tour specifically is that we're really pushing a message to the kids of being okay with who you are. You know, you're a nice guy. You're an okay person. You can be whatever you want to be. And when kids are exposed to that and they see it as a reality and they see us being fun with it and having, you know, we're jumping around the stage. They're coming up. They're trying out new things. They're doing things they've never done. We have kids getting up and reading and rapping in front of whole crowds of their peers, and they do it well. So I think that is something that gives me a little confidence. And I really like the approach that we're taking with it.
And then the other piece of it is, Mitch, is that a kid will respond a little bit more favorably to you know, authors who are coming to their school than their parents.
Right.
And so maybe we can reach them in some ways that the parents can't.
Right.
Well, and maybe the light goes off and they realize that their parents aren't entirely full of it.
Exactly.
Right. Right. That's the
hope. Exactly.
Right?
Well, and not to attach too much significance to the middle grade age, but maybe to attach some significance to it. Do you feel like, is that an age where you really, I don't want to say it's the last great opportunity to do that, but it's a pretty pivotal time. By the time they're in high school, there's a lot of stuff that's starting to, if it's, you know, concrete, it's starting to set.
I think there's still room in high school, but I think, to your point, yes, middle school is sort of like the last chance to mold and shape in a really profound way that's significantly easier than when you get to 10th and 11th grade.
Yeah.
The middle school kids are about to cross over, you know, see what I did there?
I saw what you did there.
Yeah. It's a product placement there,
exactly.
I think.
Very nice.
They're about to cross over and hopefully get booked. No, no. No, they're about to cross over into young adulthood,
right.
You know.
The surf's up, if you will.
Yes,
and that's why we have to offer them some rules for life, you know, the playbook.
Hey, work it out. Working out. I think that at the middle school age, especially, I got to do the intro. The middle school kids. No, at that age, they're suggestible. They're still trusting of adults, even people who are strangers to a degree. They trust them. So there's an opportunity there to talk to a kid about something that may be meaningful to them that they've never thought about. But because you're an adult and you have that, you know, you're taller and bigger and low voice as a man, you know. They're going to listen in a way that they may not listen to someone who's saying the same thing every day to them.
Right.
You know, I think about, you know, I've seen videos of kids interacting with you guys at schools, and I was there at Boswell the last time you were in town, and I mean, there's a certain excitement that they get from being in your presence, if you will. I was wondering, what is it like on the other side? I mean, is there a rush in some ways connecting with kids and you see those moments happen, you know, not that this is a selfish exercise for you, but it's gotta be an amazing feeling.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we feed off of that energy.
Yeah.
We just, you know, while in Milwaukee, we had two presentations, one for about 800 kids and one for about 700 kids, in really large theaters. And the energy was just bananas.
It was amazing.
And when we see a group of students respond to poetry, respond to literature, respond to the books in that way where they're clapping and chanting and the call and response is through the roof. It feeds us because ultimately we're really trying to, and it may seem a bit, you know, lofty, but our goal is to change lives.
Absolutely.
We're trying to allow children to have the space to become better human beings, you know, because the thing is when adults do things that have a negative impact on our world, you know, for example, when we look at some of the shootings of young black men that have taken place in our country, and we wonder about what transpired, what was going through that officer's mind in that moment. You know, I posit that adults, the mind of an adult begins in the imagination of a child. Mm. And so to the degree that we can create these well-rounded, connected, empathetic human beings as children, when they get older, we won't have to wonder what's in their mind, because we will have helped create a mind that is all about making the world a better place by any means necessary. And so when I see children responding to the messages, you know, to the ideas and the ideals, that's it. That's why we do this. And so you got something like that. And then you have something like we are introducing books, training teachers, building a library in a village in Ghana.
I was going to ask about that. So you have this Leap for Ghana program impacting lives on a whole different scale.
On a whole different scale. I mean, you're talking about changing the outlook, the makeup, the opportunities, the resources for our entire village of 200 children and their families.
Right.
And there was one book in their classroom. There was 11 classrooms, one book. What we're talking about is that books allow you to open up a world of possibility.
Mm-hmm.
They allow you to see outside of your own condition and begin to see things that are possible. And so whether it's a boy in Milwaukee who's going to now read a book, or whether it's an entire village who has access to books that they see themselves in and see what's possible, we're all about creating language and literature and opportunities for young people to be changed.
And at the same time, I mean, I think it's interesting because I think it was in your Newbery acceptance speech where, you know, you made reference to the fact that adults are really hung up on what ethnicity the kids in your books are, and the kids that read them, they aren't. And it feels like there's empathy is linked to kids' ability to see themselves in these characters regardless of what their physical description is.
I think you hit the nail on the head. That's another thing my grandmother used to say. It's tough for adults to sort of, you know, to see past that. Like, the kids get it. Like, yeah. The kids, they see themselves, they see their friends, and I think it's only when we begin to introduce, you know, well, I think this book will be for my black kids.
Right.
And this
right.
book should probably be for my white kids, and this book should be for my, you know, Latino kids, or
this is for girls,
or this is for boys. And so the adults begin to segregate the literature. And then we wonder why kids grow into adults who aren't empathetic, who aren't connected outside of their own house, neighborhood, community.
If you can't see the humanity in another person, then you have no reason to. You have no. There's nothing that's going to prompt you as an adult
right.
to seek that out.
Right.
And so if you've never learned that or you've never experienced that in your childhood, there's very, very few opportunities for that to happen as an adult.
Talk about how the mixtape came about.
That's a great question, especially
man.
Since it started here in Milwaukee.
Yeah, in the top of
last year in April, we were on tour for the novel Booked, and we were in the Hotel Pfister last year. We were in the lounge on the 23rd floor, eating dinner, hanging out, and we began to talk about some of the components of our presentations, and we thought maybe we should do a song about one of the books that I had written called Acoustic Rooster. And his Barnyard Band, about a rooster that starts a jazz band with Duck Ellington and Miles Davis. And so...
It's a shame Elephants Gerald couldn't be there.
Exactly. There you go. And so we sat there and we wrote this song.
Acoustic Roosters, Barnyard Band, up next in Farmer's Talent Show. Bee started humming, duck dove right in, rooster and pork chop set the flow, and the band they played,
and the band they played,
and the barnyard dance,
join in,
and the barnyard dance, and the singer sang, and the singer sang, everybody jam,
everybody jam. And so we just sat there and we wrote this song, and then we said, well, let's do a song for Surf's Up, and then let's do a song for Booked. And then, of course, with the playbook, we thought, well, that's, you know, a perfect opportunity for us to share this passionate, you know, sort of call and response piece that deals with the power of saying yes to life and understanding your own confidence. You know, and there was a kid in Singapore, and I had him write a rule, and he wrote this rule that has become the one that we do in schools. Dribble, fake, shoot, miss. Dribble, fake, shoot, miss. Dribble, fake, shoot, miss. Dribble, fake, shoot, swish. And so, you know, we figured let's give it some rhythm and rhyme. So the mixtape came out of that, and we ended up doing a CD for little kids featuring songs based on my picture books, and then one for the bigger kids featuring my novels and the playbook.
Yeah. Music creates a level of engagement that not many other things can. For kids, especially kids of this generation who are in middle school, grade school, everything they do has a soundtrack. Everything they look at has a soundtrack. If they're watching it on a screen, there's music playing. And so when we get into human interaction, a lot of times that's lost because in a classroom, the teachers are teaching the math and it's wah, 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 wah. So combining music to what we're talking about allows, again, another a level of engagement that may not have been previously.
It's our way to combat screen time, Mitch.
There you go. There you go.
Well, so it's funny. You call it a mixtape. It's on a CD, actually. And, you know, I get to thinking you're probably not all that different in age than I am. And, you know, you're playing these songs and you bring a mixtape to people for whom the concept of tape really doesn't mean anything. I mean, the idea of a mixtape has long outlived the concept of a cassette.
Which is right. Great. You know, I mean, we all made them. I made them for my girlfriends in high school.
I made them too, yeah, man.
You know, it's a big thing. And
from the radio. You just play the radio and erase the, or stop where the commercials came on and keep going, man.
It's a wonderful thing. Remember John Cusack in Say Anything?
Yeah.
What was in it? Your Eyes?
What was the other one?
Was that the song?
Peter Gabriel, yeah.
Peter Gabriel, yeah.
Well, and it strikes me that both that and Playbook are ways, you know, even after they've finished reading Booked or The Crossover or after they've left an event with the two of you, these are ways that your influence kind of lives on in their lives.
Well, we feel like the books are sort of the foundation. Mm-hmm. The words are the foundation. But this tree has many branches, Mitch.
Well, I like
there's
that.
A live performance. We love performing
I
as
love
much
performing,
as so. I love the writing. There's music. Randy loves performing and writing songs as much as I love writing books. I think, you know, it's a multimedia experience. Mitch, we're trying to bring the words off the page. We're trying to put them on the stage, Mitch. That's our goal. I like saying Mitch's name.
Evidently. Yeah. It's hilarious.
I mean, we're trying to make this an experience where young people are A, entertained.
Right.
B, inspired.
Right.
And C, empowered.
Oh, I like that.
Entertained, inspired, and empowered to now go out, read another book, and hopefully do something that's going to change the way they view the world,
right.
Or perhaps even, if we're lucky, the world.
How affirming is that?
Like, that's life-changing and life-saving.
Absolutely.
Writer Kwame Alexander and musician Randy Preston. Alexander's latest book for middle grade readers is The Playbook, 52 Rules to Aim, Shoot, and Score in This Game Called Life. He's also the author of Booked and the Newbery Medal-winning The Crossover.
Well, I feel like, would you leave us with one more song from the mixtape?
Sure. What do you want to do?
What are we going to do? I guess we'll do the Mac.
Okay, I like that one. You gonna set that up?
Yeah, so we want to thank Mitch for having us today. We want to thank everybody for listening to this amazing show. Lake Effect is in the house.
Lake Effect, baby.
Randy Preston is on the guitar. You can Kwame on my cell phone. Here we go. This is a poem from Booked, B-O-O-K-E-D. It's about a 12-year-old boy who hates reading and he loves soccer. And he hates reading until he meets a really cool librarian who gives him a playbook for life. The Mac drinks tea in a dragonfly mug. On the library floor is a dragonfly rug. The door is covered in dragonfly pics, cause Skip to the Mac is dragonfly sick. Sometimes I wear a dragonfly hat. Got dragonfly this and dragonfly
that.
Dragonfly this and dragonfly
that.
Dragonfly this and dragonfly that around my room are dragonfly clocks, but please don't touch my dragonfly box, cause if you do, I might get cross. Respect Mitch, y'all, the dragonfly boss. That's right.
That's right.
One last break, and then we'll shift gears entirely and learn about the myths, realities, and science of vitamin D and kind of demystify them when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
We're back with more of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Lake Effect essayist Jim Spangler spent much of his working life at and around newspapers, during which he met people from many walks of life.
But it was as a small-town Iowa teenager with a passion for cars that he says he learned some of his first lessons about profit, people, and prejudice as he worked a paper route.
When I hung up my newspaper bag for the last time 58 years ago, the Clinton, Iowa Herald, my hometown daily, was delivered and paid for by every single one of the 68 families on my route. That is, everyone except Old Ed, black 49 Chrysler. Like many boys of my vintage, that paper route was my first venture into high finance. I bought the papers wholesale and sold them retail with a weekly profit of about $9, except at Christmas when the tips rolled in. Many customers would give me a buck, 30 cents for the paper and the rest for my tip. A few high rollers would pay the 30 cents and then give me the dollar. And then there was Mrs. Myers, 55 Cadillac, two-door green, who tipped $5 and the 30 cents. Her paper went inside the screen door every day, and I'd ring the doorbell to tell her that the Herald had arrived. As I mentally walked my paper route of 58 years ago, I can't remember many of the names, but I can recall the cars. Mr. 53 Ford, four-door blue and white, waited on his back porch for me every afternoon. He nailed all his old license plates to the back of his garage, and he never gave me a tip. Spent too much on nails, I guess. Mr. 56 Lincoln, dark blue four-door, was a school principal someplace, and I just assumed he knew my principal. He got his paper tucked into a dry corner of his porch, rain or shine, and I didn't cut across his grass like I did everybody else's. My little Iowa hometown was not immune from the real world. However, it took the reflection of more than a few years for me to realize it. There was an old man, 50 Studebaker, two-door with a wraparound rear window, who, in good weather, would sit on a white metal chair in his front yard. He always wanted to talk as I made my rounds. "You're sure you're not a Jew?" he would often ask, and with the word Jew, he would crunch up his face. "No, I'm a Methodist," I'd respond and try to hurry past him. Young boys don't understand much about either loneliness or prejudice, but now I realize he suffered from both. We also had a German DP couple on the route, late 40s Dodge panel truck, black. He was a house painter, and his wife had the reddest hair this side of a Clairol commercial. DP stands for displaced person, and Dad said he was in the German army before he was captured by the Americans in World War II. Because of their background, they were, to some degree, the neighborhood celebrities. This in spite of the fact he was an enemy combatant little more than a decade earlier. It didn't strike me until much later that while they had been accepted so fully into our little Iowa town, others, not white and not from Europe, often report a different experience. Mr. 50 Studebaker, in his prejudice, is not alone. People paid the 30 cents for the paper by the week, so I'd collect half the route on Thursday and the other half on Friday, or fish day, as my Catholic buddy called it. The best time to find people at home was supper time. And back then, Catholic families, and there were a lot of them on my route, couldn't eat meat on Friday, so many of them served fish. Mom didn't like fish and very seldom fixed it. It's a good thing we were Methodists. And last, there was old Ed, 49 Chrysler Black. He was the only one on my route not taking the paper, and I was determined to make him a subscriber. I'd throw a free paper on his porch for a few days, then ring his doorbell and ask for his business. He would say no, and he wasn't very nice about it. And I'd try it again in 3 months or so with the same result. He would never subscribe, but I could see him through his picture window, sitting on a brown leather chair, reading every one of my free newspapers. Over a 40-year career after college and a stint in the Marines, I'd often know people who reminded me so much of my newspaper route customers. I was blessed occasionally to work with $5 tippers like Mrs. Myers. There were a lot of the $1 variety. And thankfully, only a few who, like old Ed, would only read the free newspapers.
Essayist Jim Spangler is a retired newspaperman who lives in Brookfield.
This is the time of year when people in Wisconsin talk about needing to get their vitamin D. The sun is still at a lower angle, although it's getting better every day. The clouds loom overhead, and it's said to be a given that we're vitamin D deficient.
But what are the truths behind the commonly held notions about vitamin D? Is it the panacea that some believe it is, holding the key to alleviating disease and making us healthier?
Well, Dr. Alexander Arnold took on the science of vitamin D in a series of events at UW-Milwaukee last month. He's an associate professor of chemistry and biochemistry at UWM, and he recently shared some of the vitamin D basics with us.
Vitamin D is a molecule. It's actually a pre-vitamin, and it's very, very essential, especially for bone development, for skin, for the immune system. And you're right, Bonnie, because we are now currently in a winter period. We have to make sure that we have enough vitamin D, and you probably also know that vitamin D is made by sunlight through the skin. And so it's double hard, actually, like to go outside now in the winter and to catch the sun rays we so need in order to make that molecule. Now, there are supplements we can take, but it comes down to that we have a molecule. That molecule is very, very important for us. It can interact in the human body with a receptor, and this is called the vitamin D receptor. And it's actually the receptor which is mediating all the processes we are benefiting from by taking vitamin D.
So what happens to us if we don't get enough vitamin D?
Initially, nothing really happens because vitamin D, luckily, is a molecule which is dissolved in fats. So we store a lot of vitamin D in our fat tissue. So we wouldn't really like feel anything in the first month, in the first couple of months. If it goes into years, then probably we see some effects. Mostly we see that very readily in skin. The skin starts to be very dry. It can also like shed a little bit. We don't really see that in bone formation right away. So this is a process which takes years and years of not taking any vitamin D or not being exposed to sunlight.
So rickets isn't a problem initially.
Exactly. Rickets is currently not really a problem anymore in the industrial world. There are some third world countries where it's still persistent, but people are aware of this, that actually sunlight can help. Sunlight is available everywhere on the planet. It's for free. You don't have to pay for this. You just have to like change your lifestyle. And this is sometimes not very easy if you're on a certain diet, if you live somewhere on this planet where there's not too much sun exposure, maybe like on the North Pole, there are not so many people living there for a reason. But it's also cultural things that are important. By clothing, for instance, you know, how much clothes do we have on? What is important is just to make sure that you can still have an equilibrium within yourself, that you say like, okay, I may be not exposed to sunlight, therefore I'm taking vitamin supplements.
Are there particular supplements that are recommended that do a better job? And should you take them with anything else?
No, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter the formulation. So the amount, normally vitamin D is has a unit, which is called an international unit. And the doctors say that approximately around 1,000 international units per day, that's what you would like to have as a wealthy, healthy human being. Now, the pills are sometimes have 500, 1,000, or 2,000 international units. So it's up to you to do the math, take one or two pills if you need to take supplements. But as I said, I think it's important for us to always rethink how healthy we are, what we eat, because there are also a lot of food articles which are supplied with vitamin D.
Like milk, for example. Unless you don't drink milk, which is one of my things, I don't really do it, so I have to get it somewhere else.
Right. Yeah. So there are certain breads have that, for instance. Milk is something which, you know, because it's traditionally vitamin D was actually more or less coined in Wisconsin more than 100 years ago.
Oh,
and
really?
Therefore, you know, Wisconsin had a great impact on actually making sure that food is fortified with vitamin D and that vitamin D was noticed as such an important vitamin. Now, there are other foods which are fortified with vitamin D, and there are also some foods which naturally have vitamin D. Most of them are products from animals. So, for instance, milk by itself has a small amount. Now, butter, eggs, all these foods have a certain amount of vitamin D. Even mushrooms have a particular kind of vitamin D. So it is actually possible just by selecting certain foods in your supermarket in order to be covered and have enough vitamin D.
Do the things like mushrooms, do they get vitamin D the same way we do? Do they absorb it from the sun?
Exactly, yeah.
So really every living thing that has vitamin D in it gets it from the sun?
Almost, yeah. Almost every living thing. Now, there has to be two things has to come together. First of all, you need the precursor for vitamin D, and that is cholesterol. And we all know cholesterol, but the humans have a lot of cholesterol, and it's also stored just under the skin. So when sunlight is penetrating the skin, it directly can convert that molecule, cholesterol, into vitamin D. And that's important. So this situation is not given in every organism, but in a lot of organisms. Like, for instance, I would say like plankton is probably like the biggest or the largest producer of vitamin D. This is the reason that your physician might tell you to take like some cod liver oil, for instance. Like all these fish oils are rich in vitamin D, not because the fish are actually sunbathing, no, but because the fish are eating the plankton and the plankton are actually making the vitamin D. So vitamin D is giving through the food chain by one organism to the other one. So that is an important way for us in order to get some extra vitamin D if the sunlight or sun exposure is not sufficient enough.
Are there things that when you do these conversations and you have these talks about vitamin D, are there things that people persistently get wrong about vitamin D that they say, oh, but I thought it did this or I thought it did that?
Mm.
Do you find that we all kind of misunderstand how it's used, or do we pretty much understand it?
I think there is a lot of knowledge about vitamin D. It's probably one of the most researched vitamins because it is so important for a lot of different mechanisms in the human body. Now, I think as a consumer, I think the most important thought or the most often thought is, do I have enough vitamin D? That's probably what everybody is trying to cope with. And the first solution is, you know, I can buy the supplements and then I'm sure I have enough vitamin D. What I hope to accomplish also with this interview is that people can also have a lifestyle change, you know, not by taking supplements and staying inside as long as they can, but do it the other way around. Every time you have a free minute, why don't you go outside? enjoy the fresh air, enjoy the sun, and you will see that it's not only helping with you as a human being having enough vitamin D, but I think it also makes you a little bit more a balanced human being. And you can do that throughout the workday. When you take your lunch break, for instance, go outside, sit on the bench, enjoy the sunshine, if there is sunshine, and you will see you can make vitamin D for free. But you will also come back from your break and you are much more relaxed and can take on the task of the day.
Now, I realize you are not a medical doctor, but do you ever get concerned that people might supplement too much? Is that a danger with vitamin D like it might be for vitamin A?
The danger for vitamin D is less pronounced than for vitamin A. The interesting condition or the interesting properties of vitamin D, it's fat soluble. That means if you take vitamin D, it has a little bit of different fate than, for instance, water-soluble molecules in your body. So when it's absorbed, it gets emulsified in your intestines, and then it gets actually absorbed in the lymphatic system and then transport into your blood system. And that's important because it's a very fatty molecule, and we want to make sure we don't have too much cholesterol in our blood, right? That's important because then we have problems with our blood pressure and so forth. So the molecule itself has a different fate in the digestive tract being absorbed by the lymphatic system. And therefore, there is no obvious acute effect by taking an overdose. So if you take one pill or 10 pills, you will not really feel that you have, you know, some non-beneficial effects. Because it gets first absorbed in the fat and then by time gets then reabsorbed in the blood system where it's actually converted into the real vitamin D. So what we actually see and what we actually buy in the supermarket is actually a precursor for vitamin which is active. And so vitamin D itself is actually a provitamin, whereas our body is then converting that molecule into something we call calcitriol, and this is actually the active vitamin which does all the biological, which has all the biological activity.
I didn't realize that.
So because it's a precursor, it's not acutely active. So it has to be activated in order to be active.
To actually have an effect on
exactly,
you.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That is interesting because I, you know, so when you take that 1,000 milligrams or 2,000 milligrams or whatever it is you take every morning, it has to actually get into your system first before it can actually do anything.
Exactly. Yeah. So it has to be absorbed. It's absorbed in a kind of like a special way because it's so fatty. And then in your body, your major metabolizing organs are liver and kidney, and they will convert the vitamin D into what we or what a chemist will call 1,25-dihydroxyvitamin D3. It's a long name, but that's actually the description of this really, really potent and important compound.
Dr. Alexander Arnold is an associate professor of chemistry and biochemistry at UW-Milwaukee. And that's Tuesday's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tye.
And I'm Bonnie North. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, our Project Milwaukee Segregation Matters series continues with a look at how health outcomes differ depending on where you live in Milwaukee.
Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I do hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.